Hey, it's Bantam, and this is the Digital Song Podcast. It's time to hack destiny. Chapter 18, Nothing You Can Say. Easton. The clanging of footfalls rang out as Easton ascended to Rose's landing. A strange feeling swirled around him as he anticipated giving Rose her birthday gift. It was a mixture of giddiness and sorrowful acceptance of his death, for which the Polaris diamond pendant in his pocket was a heavy reminder. He sighed as he reached the door to the room before knocking lightly.
"Come in,"
Rose's voice sang. He pushed the door in to see Rose applying foundation to her cheeks.
"Hi, Easton."
She put her makeup down. The rhinestones on the seams of her black cocktail dress glinted in the sunlight that streamed in through the loft windows. The compass rose tattoo hung above the top of the dress like a black pointed moon over a dark horizon. She glided over and hugged him.
"Happy New Year, and more importantly, happy birthday,"
Easton said as she reached her arms around his neck to hug him.
"Birthdays are no fun anymore. I'm so old now. Last year of my 20s.
Easton held her shoulders and looked at her with paternal fondness.
"When you call yourself old, Rosebud, you're essentially saying I'm old as dirt,"
he joked.
"Besides, 29 is a good age."
Although Rose's vibrant presence made him happy, the moment triggered a simultaneous feeling of melancholy because he was reminded of Song's deathly prediction, as well as his decision to trade his life for Rose's. He had attached the Polaris diamond to a gold necklace so it would hang near her heart. A talisman that would carry his memory along with his legacy? Song. He was delivering the most powerful and mystical force in history to humankind, ever since the Titan Prometheus provided stolen fire to humans, resulting in warm hearths, supple metals softened by smith-tended embers, and wars that reduced cities to smoldering piles of ash and coal. Easton's guilt swelled like a panic attack in his chest because, unlike Prometheus, he was foisting accountability for the ramifications of this untested magic-adjacent power upon unwitting Rose. The key-making event, which he and Song had planned for months, would trigger during the evening's upcoming performance, and the diamond would encode a biometric signature from Rose's body as she sang. After Easton's death, if Rose's body exhibited the same biometric expressions as during her performance on the night of the keymaking event, the diamond would encode Rose as Song's controller in its codebase and fundamental rule set. She just needed to sing that same song again to unlock Song. Easton extracted the velvet box containing the diamond from his jacket.
"With all your successes, your singing, your consulting gig, not to mention your work for the club, I figured I should get you a gift for your birthday. I'm so proud of the woman you've become. You are a star, a keen intellect, and a kind soul, and no matter what happens in our crazy lives, I love you. I have a great many faults, but I hope you can always find it in your heart to forgive my failures and think of me fondly."
He extended his reach and put the box in Rose's hands.
"Easton!"
Her eyes widened when she opened the box, then she stared at the glinting stone. She looked up at him, her eyes glassy with tears.
"Of course I love you. You've been like a father to me my whole life, but this really is too much. It's huge."
Easton smiled.
"It's not as crazy as it looks. It's a new startup that puts carbon-based matter, like peanuts and banana peels, under extremely high pressure to create custom diamonds. It basically turns compost into gems. I think the result is marvelous, so I gave this one a name. That makes it even more fun."
"I think I stumbled across this company somewhere and I wondered about them."
Rose giggled and hugged Easton. As she backed away, she extracted the diamond from its velvet box, untangled the chain, and clasped it around her neck. She turned toward the mirror on her vanity.
"What's its name?"
"The Polaris Diamond,"
Easton said in an exaggerated deep voice.
"It's amazing. Thank you."
"It's my pleasure, Rosebud. I wanted to give you something nice. This place would not be such a success without you."
He swept an open hand in front of him.
"We've had a good quarter. Think of it as a partner bonus."
He grinned.
Also, it will give you some additional glitz and dazzle during your performances.
He paused.
But you have to wear it tonight.
Rose was turned sideways, with her body bladed toward the mirror, looking at the diamond in her reflection.
I will.
That diamond is how Song my legacy will pass to Rose.
Easton thought. Once the keymaking event encoded the biometric signature during her performance that evening, all she would need to do would be to sing the same song. Then, via the complex software in the Polaris diamond, control of Song would be conveyed to her.
And one more thing,
he said.
I know it's your birthday, but can I make a request?
Of course,
Rose said.
It's been a while since you sang my favorite song. Will you sing it tonight?
She knew the one, so she just smiled and nodded. Chapter 19. Faces in Disguise. Easton. Patrons trickled through the large steel security door to the reception hall until the space was filled with the elegant New York City elite. Easton had been mingling with some of the early arrivals when he noticed Geo and Mac Mason enter. Next to Geo and Mac was another man that Easton did not recognize immediately. His memory, or his branch, told him that it was Jason Sola, the club's newest member, a successful solo practicing criminal defense attorney, whom Geo had sponsored for membership. When Easton politely excused himself from his current conversation to welcome the Masons and Jason Sola, he turned around to find LaDonna Chambers standing in his path.
Easton,
Chambers said.
LaDonna, how are you?
I see we have a new member.
Chambers rarely deigned to make small talk. Chambers pointed to Jason.
Yes, that's Jason Sola, a criminal defense attorney here in New York.
I recognize him. He defended Tobias Blackburn, the thug who killed Remy Darden.
She looked in Jason's direction.
His defense strategy suggested that Darden's murder had something to do with Arbor and the release of Branch. I resent the implication.
He was just doing his job. I watched coverage of the trial at times, and he sowed doubt in my mind. I was not convinced that Blackburn murdered Darden. The evidence did not add up.
Chambers frowned.
You've done a lot for me and for Arbor, but I don't approve of this new patron. I thought you should know.
Easton shrugged.
If only LaDonna knew that Song has hacked Branch,
he thought.
Thanks for telling me. But when everyone from the club voted, Jason received enough votes in favor of membership. Nothing I can do. That's how the club's DAO governance works.
Don't expect me to do him any favors,
Chambers said as she turned and strode away. The conversation with Chambers had not been unusual. Everything she said or did was calculated to improve Arbor's reach or its bottom line. Easton found her brash and insensitive on a personal level, but her business acumen was unmatched. Easton sighed and turned toward the Masons and the new member who followed them into the reception hall. Jason was tall with a confident, self-aware aura about him. He had puffy eyes, hiding his fatigue behind cover-up. He wore black and white pin-dot loafers that matched his tailored pin-dot dinner jacket. The outfit showed off an athletic physique. The lapels of his jacket were solid black, a fine contrast to the Pyramid Club pin affixed thereupon, as well as a contrast to the pin dots everywhere else on the jacket and the bright white shirt, bisected by an orange necktie. Seeing the new member triggered Easton's memory of Geo's request to put Jason's potential membership to a vote. Geo had been embroiled in lawsuits with workers in some of his restaurants, and his income from his culinary empire was drying up.
Sola is the best,
Geo had told Easton in a voice that betrayed the hidden fear he had for his son.
His presence in court during Mac's arraignment was enough for me to want to hire him.
Can you not find a cheaper attorney?
Don't trust any of these others, but this guy Jason, he got his client acquitted for the murder of Remy Darden. It was sensational lawyering. Nobody else has such verve or panache. I wouldn't be comfortable inviting any of them to the club.
He paused and looked at Easton.
If I go with one of these cheaper lawyers, my son risks jail time, hefty fines, years of rehab. I can't afford for Mac to go to prison. He wouldn't be able to run the company. At any rate, I don't think I could liquidate my Song token holdings fast enough to cover the costs. I'm already leveraged up to my chin. loans against my business. I have no cash, no investments, besides with the club.
He lowered his head and closed his eyes briefly.
It's a mess.
Initially unsure, Easton told Gio he would think about it before putting the issue to a club-wide membership vote. Easton had asked Song to run an analysis on Jason Sola and give Easton a factual summary about him. Song had returned moments later with a report that it delivered mentally to Easton.
Jason Sola lives in Manhattan. He owns cryptocurrency, a diversified portfolio of traditional investments, several properties in upstate New York, and a successful law practice. He is best known for defending Tobias Blackburn, the man accused and ultimately acquitted at jury trial for the murder of Remy Darden, Arbor Systems' top engineer. Mr. Sola also exposed misconduct by the NYPD surrounding the death of his law partner, Anton Sanya, which was initially deemed to be justified in police internal investigations. His research exposed the cover-up, causing the officers involved to be fired and prosecuted. He appears to be worth between around 1.5 mil to 2 mil USD total, depending on how his properties are valued, putting him squarely in the upper middle class.
He was not the typical candidate for the Pyramid Club's hyper-rich techno-elite, who tended to be 100 millionaires on the low end. Easton was leaning toward denying Gio's request to put Jason's potential membership to a vote. Then something funny happened. Song had injected what seemed to be an opinion.
Easton, I would recommend allowing Jason Sola to join the Pyramid Club.
Why?
Asked Easton, eyebrows raised.
It is difficult to distill the voluminous information that generated this conclusion meaningfully into words, but indicators in the data and my predictive analytics suggest that he is an important part of your future. This relates to...
Song paused slightly.
The choice.
This relates to our discussion that prompted the creation of the Polaris Diamond and the key-making event?
Easton asked.
Yes. I cannot divulge anything further or it could change the outcome.
Soon thereafter, Easton had sent a notification for all members to vote using their Song Program LDs. They were to cast a vote as to whether Jason should join their ranks as a member of the Pyramid Club. They could examine a profile of Jason with facts about his life, including his professional history, his pictures, his accomplishments, and a detailed description about how he helped Gio and Mac Mason. The profile of Jason displayed to each member on the Song Program LD was different. Tailored by Song to achieve maximum persuasion for each Pyramid Club member, though even Easton did not know exactly how Song did it. Ultimately, Jason was voted in as a member, and Easton gave Gio permission to pay Jason in Song tokens and formally invite him to join the club. Easton walked straight up to Gio first.
Gio,
Easton said with a smile.
Glad to see you.
You too, Easton.
They shook hands, then Gio pulled Easton in for a hug.
Great to see you too, Mac. I'm glad to hear that you beat your case.
Mac half smiled awkwardly.
I'm relieved,
he responded.
But honestly, it's all thanks to Jason.
Mac gestured toward Jason as if Mac were an MC introducing him to an audience. Easton turned to Jason and held out his hand.
Easton Card, heard a lot about you.
Jason shook Easton's hand and smiled.
Pleasure, M. Card. I'm grateful for the invite to join your club. It's impressive.
Call me Easton. Gio here speaks highly of you and your courtroom prowess. If memory serves, you defended the man accused of murdering Remy Darden?
Yeah, that's true.
That acquittal was quite an accomplishment.
He exchanged glances with Gio.
Anyhow, I hope you enjoy the experience here at the Pyramid Club. I think you'll appreciate the investment pitches, but even more, I think you'll be thunderstruck by the musical performance.
Easton cupped the outside of Jason's shoulder. A server holding a tray of champagne flutes walked up to the group of men and offered glasses of the liquid gold. Gio, Mac, and Jason each accepted, but Easton declined. Taking his glass, Jason said,
"This place is stunning."
He glanced up at the pyramid skylight, which refracted the dying smears of sunset, then looked all around and held out his arms to signify how vast and magnificent he believed the space to be. Easton and Gio chuckled.
"You haven't even seen the entertainment yet,"
Easton exclaimed.
The music is the best part.
He furrowed his brow and made dismissive gestures as if he were pushing something invisible behind him.
Forget about the investments, the food, the drinks. Rose is an extraordinary singer, and the whole band, Compass Rose, is just sensational.
Rose,
Jason muttered. Jason's eyes narrowed and his lips pursed, as if he had seen or heard something propelling him into a waking trance.
Yes, she's the singer and front person.
Oh, okay.
Jason, his focus appearing to return to Easton.
I'm excited to hear her, the band, perform.
Jason's reaction to hearing Rose's name struck Easton as strange, but he disregarded it and continued to chat with the group. After a few minutes, Easton excused himself to ensure the investment presentation and the performance were set up properly before the members were ushered into the dining and performance space.
The key-making event needs to be a success.
Easton thought to himself and to Song as he glided across the checkered black and white floor like some super chess piece unconstrained by game rules or limitations. Chapter 20. Everything in its right place. Easton. As the investment presentations came to an end, Easton felt his heart knock more rapidly in his chest.
Rose is wearing the diamond,
he said mentally to Song via Branch.
Are you prepared to initiate the key-making event?
Yes. The Polaris diamond is primed to encode the biometric signature when she starts singing.
Good.
The lights above the diners dimmed and the stage's light shifted into a warm red. There was a drum set toward the back of the stage. A glossy black upright bass leaning against a wiry stand, and a hollow body jazz guitar propped upright in a cradle. A tall lounge microphone waited patiently in the center of the stage. The deep voice of Song permeated the auditorium.
And now, Compass Rose.
The room applauded politely in anticipation. The silhouettes of the band glided across the stage. Horvath took his place behind a set of drums. Froline walked to the upright bass and picked it up from its tiny stand. Trellwood reached the guitar and threw a colorful leather strap attached to the instrument across one shoulder. Finally, with a rippling glint from the red light against her black dress, Rose strutted across the stage to the microphone. Around her neck, hanging from a gold chain, was a giant diamond that seemed to glow.
I want to dedicate this first song to Easton Card.
A few cheers accompanied the applause, and Easton noticed several members look at him as he made a praying gesture with his palms pressed together and bowed toward Rose. She walked off stage momentarily with the bassist and wheeled an upright Baldwin piano to center stage, its profile facing the audience. She grabbed the microphone under the mouthpiece and leaned closer to it as if she were about to kiss it.
It's called Pyramid Song, and it's one of his favorites,
Rose said as she positioned the microphone at her face's height when she sat at the piano bench.
Key-making sequence initiated,
Song said to Easton mentally. Easton clenched his jaws and looked up at Rose and felt like he could detect a brilliance emanating from the diamond that he had never noticed before. The applause subsided as the lights on the stage went dark but for a spotlight on Rose, seated at the piano. She began to strike the keys with her fingers, starting to play a chord progression. The music was like the calm swell of a wave that seemed to rise and then recede away. The progression grew a second time through, while Rose, with her eyes closed, humming a haunting tone into the microphone before starting to sing. The piano accompaniment continued to ebb and flow, while she started to drone on one note, which modulated, contrasting the tumbling waves of underlying chords that rushed and pushed and pulled. Then, the drum rumbled and the hi-hat clapped like the faraway thunder of the storm, syncopated with the melodic, wave-like arc of the piano chords. The urgency subsided as the lyrics promised comfort. The melodic gale had passed, but the chords continued to beat against the shores of the ear, cresting and tumbling, rising and falling, rolling and pulling. The melody calmed, as all doubt floated out of mind. During the song, the Polaris Diamond had collected the physiological metrics corresponding to every note that Rose sang and movement she made. It was measuring and transcribing the measurements of her heart rate, blood flow, pupil dilation, her breathing, her voice, her neural activity, her tactile sensations, all while she performed the Pyramid Song. By the end, the diamond had created an imprint of Rose's physical state during the course of the song, fabricating a unique key that corresponded to her body's responses to her performance. The room rang out with applause. Easton clapped his hands, a warm smile holding back the floodgates of pride and love that he felt welling in his heart.
The key-making event was successful,
Song alerted Easton mentally through Branch.
Good. Now my legacy, my great creation, Song, will pass to Rose,
he thought. Chapter 21. Easy Yoke. LaDonna. The Mercedes limousine seemed to glide uptown along FDR Drive in the darkness of the New York winter. Chambers' UD vibrated, so she pulled it from her pocket and blinked her ThoughtLock code into existence in her mind's eye. The UD screen illuminated, displaying a notification declaring that Arbor Systems had been mentioned in an investigative podcast, which had been retweeted, regrammed, and resent thousands of times. Keeping abreast of fickle social media public opinion was a chore, but Chambers knew that to be an effective CEO, she needed to monitor sentiment about her company. She commanded her branch with a thought to open the podcast application and start playing the audio. A dark-haired man dressed in a suit spoke to an investigative journalist, Dara Tate. The bottom of the app showed just over 3.2 million views since the video was released several months ago.
It's that damn Jason Solar,
she complained aloud.
Jason.
Tate was leaning forward in a leather chair with a small device in her hand.
Your defense of Master Blackburn suggested that Arbor Systems, not your client, had a motive to kill Mr. Darden. Was that a trick for the jury? Or do you really believe it?
Jason appeared relaxed in the chair, wearing a navy suit and white-collared shirt, top button undone.
Yes, Dara, I do believe that.
He leaned forward and rested his forearms on his knees.
This was an execution-style murder that occurred within days of Arbor's official release of Branch. Darden was a high-level director in the company. I currently have no direct evidence to show that Arbor was involved with Darden's murder. However, my friend and forensics investigator, who was recently hit by a iTaxi that malfunctioned in a way that hasn't satisfactorily been explained, left a series of notes describing that Darden was afraid for his safety before his death, and that he was communicating with a journalist about a scoop he said would change everything for Arbor. I'm going through them now and trying to piece everything together.
Tate's eyebrows lifted.
These are serious allegations against powerful people,
she said.
Have you thought about how they might react?
Jason smiled, white teeth glinting.
Part of being a defense attorney is making sure that powerful institutions, like the criminal justice system, don't tread on normal people. In this situation, Arbor is the powerful institution, and I'm just asking questions to challenge the narrative they fed the police. I'm no longer satisfied waiting for justice to happen. I'm tracking down the truth in advance and dropping it on justice's scales so that even with that blindfold on, she knows what's right from the weight of it.
Chambers frowned.
Over 3 million views,
she thought, as Jason continued to describe why he believed Arbor was involved in Darden's death.
I need to solve the problem before this theory achieves critical mass and has people questioning Branch's security. It may take more than PR and lawyers.
Chambers muttered to herself. She rifled through the satchel on the seat next to her, pulled out a thumb drive, and inserted it into the port on her UD. She then mentally commanded her UD to open and switch to privacy mode, accessed the Cryptograph IQ layered encryption browser, and navigated to Darktasker. She held her UD in front of her face and stared at the Submit a Request button on the main page of the Darknet service portal. Tasking Pomodore was a drastic step, so it would have to pay dividends.
Not yet,
she said aloud, tossing her UD onto the seat next to her, before turning to watch Brooklyn streak by outside her car window. Chapter 22. Trumpets. Mac. Fright tightened Mac's chest, scrambling his thoughts. He knew he would receive the call eventually. He was in debt to Esri after the seizure of his Tesla by police. He had feared meeting her in person, but it was about to happen. The instructions sent in text to his UD were clear. Never drive to the building. Wear jeans, dark sunglasses, and a nondescript jacket. He emerged from the subway with his peacoat collar high around his neck and face, beige scarf pulled up over the tip of his nose, visi shades down, black stocking cap pulled down over his forehead, as instructed. As he walked west, he could see the East River in front of him with the southern point of Manhattan like a backdrop behind it. His heart started to beat rapidly, and for some reason, a jazzy trip-hop song with a trumpet popped into his head, the horn warning him about the situation he was walking into. One block from Pier Park 5 near the Brooklyn Bridge, Mac's UD vibrated as a message populated in the lenses of his visis. Turn left now.
She knows my location.
He felt big beads of sweat on his forehead and wiped them with his sleeve. Instructions continued to trickle in from his UD to his visis, and they guided him to November Arcology, a tall building with alternating levels of glass and garden on a large parcel near the water, with copper-colored metal I-beams. Arcologies, Arcos for short, were a new type of real estate design meant to incorporate natural spaces in vertically reaching residential buildings. Mac could see hardwood trees growing out of the roof of the November Arco like giant follicles of hair. Arcos had popped up all over the city in the past 2 decades. Developers and investors began favoring tall buildings with built-in naturescapes. Aerial photos of New York City began taking on a green hue as Arco rooftops became home to parks with stands of trees. One of the most famous Arcos, built on the plot of a demolished housing project in the far Upper East Side, looked like an 80-story glass soup can with a nature park on the top, covered by an enormous tulip-shaped glass dome. Flowerbud Arco was the newest and hottest place to live for the techno elite. Mac walked into the November Arco lobby, which had high ceilings and grandiose white marble walls and floors. The security guard sat behind a desk made of marble, like a strange acolyte behind an altar to largesse. For a split second, Mac imagined Esri tying him to the marble desk altar and cutting his heart out as punishment for his failures, his blood running down the shiny white stone in red rivulets. He plodded to the desk. Watching Mac, the guard tapped his right ear, which housed a black piece of plastic shaped like the negative space where the ear canal began. He glared as Mac approached.
Yeah,
the guard said, still staring.
I'll let him up.
The guard flicked his head, gesturing toward the elevator bay. All the elevator doors were closed save one, so Mac tentatively stepped into it. There were no buttons, just a black glass plate inset into the elevator wall. As Mac pivoted around to face the inside elevator doors, they closed, and he felt the inertia of the elevator as it pulled him upward. It halted suddenly at the top floor, and while his feet remained on the ground of the elevator, his stomach, throat, and eyeballs felt the continuing upward force until the grip of gravity's normal downward pull returned. The elevator doors split apart, revealing a large steel wall blocking entry to whatever area was behind it. As soon as a new wave of anxiety and confusion began to tug at Mac, the wall rumbled, sliding open to reveal a large luminous room, entry to it blocked by a grizzly bear-sized man.
UD and Vizzy's in the box,
said the giant, holding a steel cube the size of a Rolex gift box in one hand. Mac pulled his UD from his pocket, removed his Vizzy's from his face, and placed them in the box. As the guard locked the compartment in the box and set it on a table by the elevator door, the cords in his neck seemed to strain. When he looked back up at Mac, his eyes strafed over Mac's body. Then he looked down the length of the condo and pointed aggressively in that direction.
That way, he said.
Mac nodded, gulped, and proceeded without question. The giant condo's entirely glass outer walls stretched from floor to top of the 16-foot ceiling. The walls and glossy white floor tiles shone like freshly cleaned teeth in a minatory smile. All the wall art and furniture displayed motifs of blood red and inky black. Mac walked warily ahead. He looked to his right and saw a room with screen projection equipment and several computer terminals with lines of code appearing. Esri's tightly knit and insular criminal organization had created decentralized darknet platforms like Darktasker, Golden Apple, and Cerberus to facilitate ransomware schemes, distribution of drugs, and theft of software from tech companies. Mac turned a corner in the condo, which opened into a large den. Along the wall to his right rose a pedestal mimicking the top of an Ionic column with a basketball-sized sculpture that resembled a giant gilded apple with an inscription reading Te Kalistai, which Mac did not understand. The room had an enormous maroon suede couch, which looked like a segmented serpent sleeping. The couch's chrome railings and cylindrical arm pillows complemented the corkscrew-shaped light fixture that hung over a mirrored table. Draped on the couches, like the velvet blankets next to them, were two muscular naked men lying on each other. A nude woman on the other side of the couch slept with one leg outstretched and the other bent into a triangle, her breasts gently pulled to the outer sides of her chest by gravity. There were two other women lying entwined in an embrace on the white shag carpet that covered the floor under and around the couch. Another man lay legs spread, his manhood visibly resting on the diagonal crease separating his leg from his lower torso. High-end liquor and wine bottles stood uncapped on the mirror table, alongside several tumblers with diluted caramel dregs and wine glasses with red residue. Powdery smears on the table warped the images reflected from its surface. Beyond the couches was a white Berbor armchair facing the inside of the room, a modernist throne, white leather with buttoned upholstery, and a high seat back that curled at the top, tongue-like and suggestive. The chair was accented by its frame of black and its gilded feet. Its curling armrests were poofy cushions. A small, naked person with olive skin, Mac knew it was a woman, made the already large chair look enormous. She reclined lazily across both armrests, emulating a Roman patrician spectating at an orgy, presiding over her nude guests like a judge in the court of carnal behavior. She propped herself up against one of the armrests with her forearm as she held a gigantic bulb of a wine glass in the other hand, casually swirling the deep burgundy liquid. She had short bleach blonde hair with black streaks and large glasses that enlarged her strange golden eyes.
"You found the place!"
she yelled across at Mac, her legs dangling off the side of the armrest. Her voice was a screech, like a defensive cat or an owl. She continued to slowly swirl her wine.
"Yeah, I found it,"
Mac said, more meekly than he intended.
"I expected you to take off?"
"No, Esri, I would never,"
she interrupted him.
"I thought you would take off because, if we are being honest with each other, you're a pathetic little bitch."
Some of the naked bodies stirred slightly from their stupors, one of the women repositioning her arm over her face so the crease of her elbow fit over her nose and her arm covered her eyes.
"I..."
Mac could not think of what to say.
"I..."
he sputtered again.
"But you stuck around,"
she said as she pressed herself up to seated in the chair.
"It's strange to be terrified of a tiny naked woman,"
Mac thought. At that moment, he realized her pubic hair was shaped like a star, distracting him even further.
"I'm surprised. I thought you were a complete coward."
She got up, gulped the remaining wine into her mouth, and walked quickly toward Mac. Her wine glass hung upside down by her side, leaving a trail of wine droplets tracing her vector. Her golden eyes flashed with each step. Mac, eyes wide with anxiety, tried to stand his ground without flinching.
"Esri, I can pay you back for the package."
His voice quavered. Esri had traversed 60 feet across the living room area from her seat.
"Money does not concern me."
She carelessly tossed her wine glass over her shoulder and it arced and fell to the floor, shattering.
"Discretion concerns me. Stupidity concerns me. Unwanted attention concerns me."
As Ezri finished her sentence, she reached Mac and without stopping or slowing down, she grabbed the sides of his face and aggressively locked her lips against his, shoved her tongue into his mouth, and started to violently kiss him. He instinctively struggled, lifting his hands to push her away. In one smooth motion, she pulled out of the kiss, nimbly bent down, grabbed Mac's left leg with both of her arms, and yanked it upward, causing Mac to tumble backwards onto the shiny white tile floor. Thunk. His head landed on the ground. She held up a knife, like a miniature sword no bigger than a letter opener, knelt next to Mac's head, not seeming to feel self-conscious about her nakedness. She wheeled the knife down in an arc motion next to Mac's face, then tapped it against the tile.
Out!
Ezri yelled, still staring at Mac. Behind the bare body of his aggressor, Mac could see the guests quickly rise, gather their articles in a frenzy, and scurry toward the door. Their clothes were held up against their chests and crotches, and shoes dangled in their hands. Meanwhile, Ezri tapped her blade against the tile in a repetitive staccato next to his ear.
You lost my fucking software! You fucking destroyed it! It was beautiful! It was my masterpiece! Do you know what it took to steal that information and stitch it together? It was priceless!
I can make it up to you,
Mac whined.
You have nothing to offer me. I'd be satisfied with a hole in your head and an easily cleanable red smear on my tiles.
She stood up and stomped her tiny foot onto his chest. Her eye contact remained intensely fixed.
I have something to offer.
Ezri's bodyguard approached with an emotionless face and handed her a balled-up paisley silk robe, which Ezri swung around her body and tied at the waist. She held out her hand again, still staring at Mac, and the bodyguard handed her a pistol, which she pointed at him.
Your incompetence ruined important relationships. It lost me years of work and tens of millions of dollars. You fucked me.
Wait!
Mac yelled.
What do you want, Ezri? I can get you whatever you want.
I'm not optimistic that you can provide any value. What matters to me is my reputation. If I keep you alive, what value is that? It shows mercy. Mercy is literally the opposite of what I'm going for.
She cocked the gun.
Bye-bye,
Mac groveled.
What about a diamond? I'll get you a diamond, the biggest diamond I've ever seen.
Ezri's metallic eyes flashed like a moving light against a golden blade. Her face slowly morphed into an insane smile.
Now that sounds like potential value. Explain.
I know a place, an investment club, the Pyramid Club, Sirius Security, Cyber Protections, with a singer.
I'm bored.
Ezri broke eye contact with Mac by histrionically rolling her head and eyes. Then she kicked Mac in the ribs. He coughed.
Wait, the singer. She wore a gigantic diamond around her neck. Biggest fucking diamond I have ever seen. Probably worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions.
Ezri glanced at her bodyguard, who shrugged. She looked back down at Mac.
How big?
Ezri asked calmly.
A silver dollar.
Ezri cackled.
What the fuck is a silver dollar?
She paused, as if she were having an internal dialogue. She glanced at her wrist, which had a screen band of some kind. Mac thought she might have been conjuring up the image of a silver dollar with her branch and transmitting the image to the screen band. But then he remembered that Ezri never used branch or UDs because of the risk of them being hacked and used to surveil her. She lowered the pistol.
That seems big enough to consider. Let's go right now.
Ezri commanded.
We can't. We need a plan. The club, it's like a fortress.
How?
Entrance is protected by security guards.
Mac's anxiety prevented him from forming clear sentences.
Crazy high-tech cyber defenses and security. Biometric security. You need to be given a physical key. You need to be vetted and have an invitation. You can't just show up. There is only one entrance that I know of besides the kitchen, which is a crazy bottleneck. It took my dad months to get my lawyer a membership.
Why have I not heard about this place before?
She squinted.
It's secretive, low profile. It's an investment DAO. It has a team of incredibly successful analysts and yields a 30% ROI every year.
He paused.
I signed an NDA when I joined, and the singer, the one who wears the diamond, she's amazing. She performs after investment presentations.
How do I know you're not fucking with me?
I swear, I'm not fucking with you. I'm telling God's truth.
Ezri knelt next to Mac, whose jaw was clenched with fear.
Mac, you're going to help me get that diamond or I'm going to rip your balls off with your own jaws, then shoot you in the eye.
She paused.
Now you've heard God's truth, and you heard it from your God herself.
Mac knew that he was now Ezri's pawn. When she took her foot off his chest, she cackled loudly and commanded Mac to sit down in her living room. They discussed the plan for hours. He described to Ezri the club's four pillars of security that protected it against physical or digital infiltration, access, or attack. As he spilled his knowledge of the club, he felt pangs of guilt. The club was a source of great joy for his father. Easton was Geo's best friend. The club had created great wealth in his family. Nevertheless, Mac acquiesced to Ezri's demands, convincing himself that he could eventually wiggle out of the situation without affecting Geo's life. As he watched Ezri speak, he noticed she seemed more interested in the club's computer network than the diamond. Ezri wanted descriptions of the club's cyber capabilities, defenses, and infrastructure. He sensed that she detected an opportunity beyond mere theft of the jewel.
The next stage of your mission is to attend another gathering,
Ezri told him.
You need to obtain useful information about the unseen parts of the club. Your life and whether it will ever belong to you again depends entirely on if you can execute my plan. You are going to retrieve this diamond for me. Only then will I release you from your obligations to me.
His heart thumped as he rode the elevator down to the November Arco lobby. That evening's Pyramid Club event would be his first opportunity to earn his life. He needed to prove to Ezri that he could gather valuable information. Thanks for listening to the Digital Song Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. All writing is 100% original and human imagined and created by me, Bantam Drexler. All editing and audio engineering done by me. Original music by me, augmented by Suno. Podcast voice audio generated using 11 Labs. Copyright Bantam Drexler. Follow me on any of the socials, at Bantam Drexler, or check me out at bantamdrexler.com. See you in the future.